You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. And today's broadcast is in memory of W.G. Woodell. Here's the continuation of Gwyneth Everlasting by Michelle Ruiz, which is the April 2025 Vanity Fair cover story. College is a great equalizer, Paltrow says, though she remembers dropping off Apple, standing in an elevator, realizing, oh, this is a thing. I feel the energy. I feel the stares. Apple had a few uncomfortable experiences, but Paltrow doesn't seem worried. Look, they're the children of two super famous people. And so they understand what comes with that. They've grown up in it, she explains. You would be surprised at how lovely and unassuming and down-to-earth they are. Following the British, as the family lived in England first, Paltrow raised them with the mantra of manners maketh man. Perhaps contrary to expectation, she is not a practitioner of gentle or child-led parenting. They're not supposed to lead themselves because it challenges their survivability in nature, she says. In a Goop TikTok, Paltrow laughs heartily at an off-screen narrator's quip that she loved being a Nepo baby so much she created two of her own. This, despite her distaste for the term. She has shared that Danner tried to steer her away from Hollywood, deeming her too smart for it. I'm sure my mother was writing stuff on her transparency and projecting it onto me, Paltrow recalls the earlier metaphor. As they both know, it can be a very painful career. Paltrow has no such designs on her children's futures. She might have tried to dissuade them when they were younger. Now, I feel like the world needs artists, especially in the face of AI, she muses. We need real art that comes from souls and hearts. Plus, Paltrow is settling into the knowledge that parenting from birth on is just a lengthy exercise in letting go. There's this deeply inherent pain in letting go, because we've paired it with protecting them. And we can't always protect them, she says. We have to deeply let go and let them have their own experience and be the kind of person that they want to boomerang back to. The Paltrow Martins reconvened in Paris in November for Les Bals des Debutantes, where Apple debuted in a Valentino confection with tiers of blue chiffon, custom-made by Alessandro Michel himself. The high fashion, Paltrow wore sheer polka-dot Valentino and glittery privilege. Apple was escorted by Austro-German Count Leo Henkel von Donnersmarck, sparked retro Gwyneth levels of fascination online. Apple always had a lot of trepidation around being in the public eye, Paltrow says, with the exception of attending her dream Chanel Couture show in 2023. When Apple was invited to the ball and expressed an interest, Paltrow thought, well, it's a very unusual kind of thing to do, but said, we're going to embrace this and support you. She remained dubious, asking Apple, is Dad going to wear a tie and do this waltz? Martin, indeed, wore the tie and did the waltz. In the end, Paltrow submitted to Paris magic. Sometimes we need some levity, and we need frosting on the cake. Joined by Danner and her brother Jake, it was honestly one of the most special weekends of my entire life. The subsequent photos of Paltrow and Martin happily coexisting with their children at the Shangri-La Hotel provided the latest glimpse at their long exercise in conscious uncoupling, a concept introduced via Goop, alongside the news of their separation in 2014. It was first coined by therapist Catherine Woodward Thomas. Back then, Paltrow's website crashed, the culture wobbled on its axis, and as ever, intense eye-rolling abounded. Declaring their desire for a humane divorce shouldn't have been that controversial. But Paltrow says she understands how people might have interpreted her and Martin's lofty plan as an indictment of their own divorces or their parents. Paltrow struggled to adhere to the mission herself in the early days. She remembers one standing Sunday brunch in L.A. with Martin and the kids. We were in a really bad spot. I was like, F this, I cannot do this. To his credit, Paltrow says, Martin looked me in the eyes and he was like, I love you, we can do this. She softened and they all proceeded to brunch. Of her relationship with Martin now, it's not quite brother, but we are complete family, Paltrow says. He is there for me through anything and vice versa. How has conscious uncoupling expanded to include Falchuk? His ex-wife, Suzanne Bukinik, from whom he split in 2013, plus Martin's longtime girlfriend, Dakota Johnson. It's actually quite beautiful, Paltrow says, of their blended family unit. It continues to evolve. For example, Bukinik recently stayed with Paltrow, Falchuk, and Isabella in Montecito when she was evacuated during the fires. It feels much better when everybody can be together and people can let go of the more difficult, painful parts of what led to a divorce and focus on the things that led to the marriage in the first place, Paltrow says. Once you fully let go of we used to sleep in the same bed vibes, a world of possibility opens up. It's not without complication, but I love Chris, Paltrow says. I love Suzanne. Though she's held hands with Johnson on Instagram and called her a good friend in the past, Paltrow does not mention her in the equation. Decades after their 1997 breakup, Paltrow remains friendly with ex-fiancé Pitt and ex-boyfriend Ben Affleck, too. Pitt may be forever mentioned alongside her, with their matching blonde side parts, a coincidence, she said, and granny glasses immortalized in 90s nostalgia. He's a very intriguing character, Paltrow acknowledges, seemingly unbothered by the association. It's like having dated, I don't know, Prince William or something. That's always going to come up. Still, the star of Sliding Doors doesn't ponder alternate realities. I really embrace the roads that I take, she says. I almost never go back and noodle about choices. The moving trucks arrive from L.A., and the scene is elegantly goopy as far as moves go. A Tetris board of cleanly taped boxes amasses in Paltrow's driveway. The crew unloads at least one Pilates reformer. Someone asks Paltrow's head of security where she wants the wine. Paltrow speaks to staffers in fluent Spanish, then nuzzles Falchuk, who's appeared by the side door in a shawl collar sweater and shearling clogs. This is Falchuk's favorite Gwyneth. She's the best when she's home and relaxed and totally unguarded. Cooking in her pajamas, or topless when the burners get too hot, goofy and sexy and sophisticated all at once, he emails me weeks after our interview. The joy she takes in looking after everyone and in her morning coffee, the occasional OF-off I hear from my office when she drops something or reads an email she doesn't like. I think the one narrative that is right about her is that she really loves her life, and she works hard to give everyone else the opportunity to feel that way about their own. 2 days ago, Paltrow was taking Moses to LAX. After 5 weeks at home, he seemed conflicted about going back to college. It's so interesting that we are hardwired to be uncomfortable with change, Paltrow says. Change is the only axiom on the planet, every single day. Trial by Fire. Los Angeles is said to have no seasons, but what it does have is what Joan Didion called the weather of catastrophe, of apocalypse. Photojournalist Stuart Pally turned his camera on this year's wildfires and shares his account of devastation and resilience. Opening photo. The Palisades Fire burns on Tuesday evening, January 7th. I took this photo looking northwest from the Pacific Ocean in Santa Monica. You can see the pier in the distance with a red headlamp illuminating the waves. I was at my cabin in Joshua Tree right before the wind started up. The air was totally still. The sky was clear. The stars were sparkling. My gut was telling me this was the calm before the storm. In this case, it was a firestorm. Over the years, I have photographed what the Santa Ana winds can do. The gales that regularly blast through Los Angeles are legendary, and with barely a drop of rain in Southern California in 8 months, the land was tinderbox dry and primed for an inferno. That's exactly what happened the next day, many times over. The first of the two major conflagrations, the Palisades Fire, had erupted before I began driving my pickup back to L.A. on January 7th. By the time I got home to Newport Beach, dropped my dog off, got through traffic, and reached Santa Monica, it was 6:30 p.m. It was dark, and you could just see a glow on the northern horizon. Instead of rising high into the sky, the smoke column was leaned over sideways, pushed horizontal by the heavy winds. I had an anemometer, a portable wind gauge, and there were 45-mile-per-hour gusts at the beach where I was standing. My guess is that on the ridgetops it was blowing at 60 to 70 miles per hour. I thought, okay, aircraft aren't even going to be able to fly until at least tomorrow. On one side was the Pacific, but cresting those hills was another ocean, this one made of flames. The winds blew sparks over the peaks. It was literally a wave of fire crashing down the hill. I shot the fire with the Santa Monica Pier in the foreground. Palm fronds and street signs were flying out into the water. My face was red from standing on the edge of the surf because all the sand coming off the beach was sandblasting me. Then the Eaton Fire started just east of L.A. near Pasadena and middle-class Altadena. By the time I got there, the chaos looked like a war zone. The visibility was maybe 25 feet. There were spot fires and embers in a park, which people were trying to put out themselves. Large branches had come down everywhere. I had to push open my truck door with both arms because there was so much wind pressure keeping it shut. There were fire engines everywhere. People walking down the street with bags, loads of cars backed up. I knew that a lot of people, including people I knew and cared about, might be losing their homes that night. Next photos. Hundreds of embers fly off decorative mini palm trees at a McDonald's during the early hours of the Eaton Fire in Altadena. And Los Angeles County firefighters from Engine 233 pull hose from their engine to protect structures in Altadena. I drove by a senior care home that had just been evacuated. They got nearly 200 people onto city buses and were gone by the time I got there. But I saw empty hospital gurneys and beds just rolling down the road in the wind. The mattresses were blowing off and getting wrapped around palm trees, which were igniting on top, throwing embers off, and starting more spot fires downwind. I saw the crew of one Los Angeles County fire engine trying to put water on a home that was ablaze. It was already a total loss, but they were trying to stop it from igniting neighboring homes. Even a fire engine with its high-pressure deck gun shooting a torrent of water was like pissing in the wind at that point. My goal with this fire photography is for people to be better prepared, for them to take the evacuations seriously, and maybe beforehand clear brush to fortify their homes. I hope it can help make firefighters' jobs easier in educating the public. Safety and respect are important to me. I stay out of the way of first responders, and when I returned to photograph residents returning to where their homes used to be, I did not photograph any homeowners unless I had their permission. This has been a terrible tragedy. We have to be realistic about the risk of where we've built, because these fires will happen again. By Stuart Pally, as told to Anthony Bresnikan. And in additional photos, burned cars and skeletal trees in the historic Pacific Palisades north of Sunset Boulevard. This was the night of Thursday, January 9th, 2 days after the fires erupted. The entire block was destroyed, and there was no electricity, so the only lighting was from my truck's headlights. Although the fire had passed by now, charred branches continued to fall from the trees, and toxic debris smoldered in the cavities left by the homes that had been consumed. The area was silent. Even first responders were gone. Here, there was simply nothing left to protect. A drone image of a residential block in Altadena that had been incinerated by the Eaton fire. This was Thursday, January 30th, nearly 3 weeks after the fires had begun. Just a few days before, it had rained for the first time in months, dousing the last stubborn embers of the fire, but creating a gray sludge that covered much of what was left behind. Residents had been allowed to explore the remains of their homes, with the warning that asbestos, heavy metals, and other dangers were lurking in the wreckage. In the center of the frame, you can see an unblemished white car. That is likely an evacuee returning to inspect the ruins. Contractors working for the Environmental Protection Agency examined the remains of a home in Altadena for hazardous substances on Friday, January 31st. The crews, who wore full-body hazmat suits, hard hats, and respirators, which they had to change every time they visited a new property to avoid spreading contaminants, found asbestos fibers and unstable propane canisters. Not all civilians had protective gear. Here, William Hilliard sifts through the remains of his home in western Altadena on January 30th. He and his wife wore a simple face mask as they dug through rubble in search of anything salvageable. Hilliard said he lived in Altadena for 30 years and barely had time to grab anything before fleeing. A reverse of the opening image, this shot looks south from the ruins of the Palisades fire toward the glow of Santa Monica and its amusement park pier. This was Malibu on January 9th, 2 days after the fires broke out. Smoke obscured direct sunlight as gray overtook the region at dusk. The fire burned homes from the bluffs overlooking the coastline right down to the Pacific Ocean.
Thank you.
style driver. Fashion forward Simone Ashley revs up for a role in Brad Pitt's summer blockbuster F1. By Rebecca Ford. Photographs by Camilla Akrens. Styled by Leith Clark. Simone Ashley photographed at the Lanesborough Hotel in London on February 2nd. Simone Ashley's parents supported her dream of being an actor when she was a teenager, but a few years later, they seemed to be watching the clock. When I was in my early 20s, they were still open to it, the actor says on a video call from her home in London. But I think secretly they were like, oh, when you hit 25, that's when you have to get serious. I didn't really explain how much I wanted it and how hard I was working for it, because I wanted the work to prove that I could do it. Then, when I, thankfully, could make a living off doing this, I think they were just like, cool, she's fine. Fine doesn't do justice to Ashley's trajectory. By the time she was 25, she had a steady gig as a popular bubblegum-popping high schooler in sex education with Gillian Anderson. By 26, she'd broken out on the second season of Bridgerton as Kate Sharma, an independent young woman who'd rather race through the countryside on her horse than promenade around a ballroom waiting for a gentleman to ask her to dance. Now Ashley has scored a plum role in F1, Brad Pitt's Formula One racing film, which roars into theaters in June. I'm really out to show such a range of things I can do, she says. Being dark-skinned, being a culturally specific woman in Hollywood, it's about finding the right kind of project where you just see the humanity in someone. Along the way, she has added all manner of things to her resume. She's appeared in an espresso commercial with George Clooney and become a L'Oreal Paris brand ambassador, as well as a fashion it girl who wore a sequined midnight blue Prabal Garang gown and purple eyeshadow that evoked a young Cher to the Met Gala last year. Ashley's parents, Letha and Gunasekaran Pillai, were Tamil academics who immigrated from southern India to Surrey, England, before she and her older brother, Sean, were born. Ashley demonstrated an aptitude for singing early on, so her parents arranged for lessons, which led to musical theater. Then I watched a bunch of Quentin Tarantino movies, and I just got the bug, she says. I explored film and decided that this was what I wanted to do. Ashley had enough of a rebellious streak to leave school at 16 to pursue acting and spent some of her teens with relatives in and around Los Angeles. At 18, she started to model and try out for roles and later honed her acting skills at performing arts school back in London. Anytime I got rejected or told I couldn't do something, it felt strongly external, she says. I never let it hit my heart. That feeling of believing in myself always outweighed any external denial I may have faced. With Kate, Ashley brought a more modern protagonist to Bridgerton, a sharp, quick-witted outsider who also happened to look stunning in jewel-toned gowns. It turned out to be just the right combination to bedazzle Anthony Bridgerton, played by Jonathan Bailey, and the two of them ended the season as Viscount and Viscountess. Bridgerton raised Ashley's profile, but she was careful not to get confined to the genre. Along with signing on for F1, a movie she calls one of the coolest experiences of my life, she appeared as one of Ariel's sisters in 2023's live-action The Little Mermaid, took on the psychological thriller This Tempting Madness, and starred in the rom-com Picture This. In Picture This, which came out in March on Prime Video, Ashley plays Pia, an aspiring photographer who's told by a spiritual guru that she'll meet the love of her life in her next 5 dates. I always wanted to be the leading lady in a rom-com, she says. and to represent more women that look like me as that kind of Bridget Jones character. Along with displaying her charm and comedic chops, Picture This gave Ashley her first executive producer credit, which let her ensure that her own background was accurately represented in the woman she played. "We celebrate her heritage," she says. "The joy and the comedy is also in celebrating the culture." Now Ashley is having a homecoming of sorts by returning to Bridgerton for its fourth season, which will air next year. This time around, Kate is a new mother, so there are fresh waters for Ashley to dive into. "There was so much drama and volatility before," she says. "Now when I play her, she's much softer, which is super fun." Ashley is also recording her debut album for Universal Music with producer Fraser T. Smith, who has worked with Adele and Drake, among others. She describes the album as pop, with some R&B references, and says she's been inspired by the likes of Sade and Alicia Keys. She hopes the album could lead to starring in a movie musical someday. She'd also love to play an action hero, a Lara Croft type. "It's really good to lean into having fun with it and not taking it all too seriously and taking opportunity when it comes." Ashley has always admired the way Dev Patel has shaped his career. "I definitely don't want to be playing characters that feel overly stereotypical," she says. The doors haven't always been open to her. She's been on auditions where it was clear she would not get the role because of her skin color. "I have been very close to getting big life-changing roles, but losing them to a blonde actress," she says. "This is why it's so amazing how supportive women of color in Hollywood are. We all speak the same language, and we all understand that kind of hurdle." In low moments, Ashley sometimes calls up Wicked star Cynthia Erivo, who became a friend and mentor after they met on the Ellen DeGeneres show in 2022. "She's just done it and proved that women like us get bums in seats." God complex. Silicon Valley was once driven by a godless chase for growth. Now the new religion is religion. By Zoe Bernard. Opening illustration of a pixelated Jesus by Tamim Sankari. It's mid-October in San Francisco, and a crowd of 200 or so congregants, some seated in pews, others standing below cathedral windows at the back, bow their heads in prayer. Over cranberry apple cosmos and plates of Burmese food served by black-shirted waiters, a DJ plays a thumping soundtrack of remixed worship music. This is not a church service or even a Bible study. It is, instead, an entirely new kind of event in Silicon Valley. We are here to listen in on a conversation between Dr. Francis S. Collins, the former director of the National Institutes of Health and leader of the Human Genome Project, and Gary Tan, the president and CEO of Silicon Valley's influential startup incubator Y Combinator, which has hatched thousands of tech companies with a combined valuation of more than $600 billion. The event is called Code and Cosmos, and its underlying thesis is that the fields of science and technology, once considered diametrically opposed to religion and spirituality, might converge with the teachings of the Bible. In other words, business networking for the spiritually curious. What is the real basis of morality? Collins asked the crowd. Why am I here? What happens after I die? Collins, a thin, owlish man, gazes solemnly at the crowd, which already seems to have a sense of where this is going. Science, he says, can't really give you an answer. But there is another answer to these questions, and it has to do with one Jesus Christ of Nazareth, whom Collins encountered as a 20-something medical student grappling with the limits of atheism. Ever since, he said, I've never really hit a situation where what I know as a rigorous scientist and what I believe as a Christ-centered Christian are in conflict. That this conversation is taking place not at a church, but in Tan's home, which, incidentally, happens to be a converted church, a stone's throw from Dolores Park, may seem, as Tan tells us from the stage, a little bit unusual. There was a time, Tan says, when such a gathering would be maybe even reviled in San Francisco. Many in the room, myself included, remember vividly the period to which Tan is referring. It was a time not so very long ago, mostly in the 2010s, when Silicon Valley cultivated a stance of pointed hostility, not only toward conservatism, but to the Protestant doctrines that underpin much of American life. For many years, the running joke, popularized by the HBO show Silicon Valley, was that in the Bay Area, Christianity was borderline illegal. Of course, there have always been Christians in Silicon Valley. They just knew better than to advertise their faith. This is to say, the Christians were effectively in hiding. And one specific place they were hiding was, according to Tan, on a spreadsheet made up of Christians in tech, which was passed around for years among a dozen or so of the techno-faithful. One of them was Trey Stevens, co-founder of the defense tech company Anduril and a partner at Founders Fund, the venture capital firm co-founded by Peter Thiel. Stevens, like Tan, has lately been speaking publicly about his faith in the context of Silicon Valley. He has hosted a Bible study reflecting on the teachings of René Girard, a French philosopher popular in certain libertarian-leaning tech circles, spoken at his church about the connection between Christianity and innovation, and written in what seems a slightly contorted interpretation of the gospel about how basic venture investing principles are an exemplar of divine forgiveness. Near trays of sticky rice laid out on white tablecloths stood a woman with substantially false eyelashes, who, when I asked if she worked in tech, eyed my press credential nervously. "I'm an investor," she said, "in tech." When I prodded her further on what sectors she invested in, she doubled down. "I told you," she barked, "I invest in tech. Tech." She opened up only slightly when, to make conversation, as we stood waiting to speak to Tan, I asked if she was a Christian. Yes, in fact, she was, and had been for many years. And while she did not feel, in response to my suggestion, that she was unable to speak openly about her faith, it was a topic she avoided bringing up in professional settings, until the past year or so, when she began to sense a change. In recent months, she felt so comfortable as to wear her cross in public, and here she gestured to her neck, around which dangled a sparkly cross charm the size of my pinky fingernail. Nowadays, Christianity is rarely met with direct hostility in Silicon Valley, but there is still the lingering sense, at least in intellectual circles, that practicing it is a faux pas, said Michelle Stevens, who is Trey Stevens' wife and the founder of the organization hosting the Code and Cosmos event, Acts 17 Collective. The organization is named after a passage in the Acts of the Apostles in which the Apostle Paul visits ancient Greece and preaches the gospel to intellectuals. "Like, how are you a smart person," she asked, "and a Christian?" Part of the problem is that for most of Silicon Valley's existence, its overarching monoculture privileged a certain type of smart person. It was the kind of smart person who campaigned for Barack Obama, marched for gay rights, and built a custom prayer stool to complement their priest fetish at the Folsom Street Fair. The subject of ethics was brought up frequently, but almost exclusively in the context of their non-monogamous relationships. In the photos, the apostles, Trey Stevens, co-founder of Anduril, Gary Tan, CEO of Y Combinator, and Peter Thiel, former CEO of PayPal, are three of the most visible technologists shepherding Silicon Valley into its religious reawakening. Black Lives Matter signs sprouted from their yards, and if they strayed beyond the strictures of atheism into spirituality, it was of the Eastern variety. Being Muslim was actually kind of cool, because if you were against that, you were probably xenophobic. And Judaism was all right, too, because anti-Semitism was not yet in vogue. Maybe you know this person, or maybe you are this person, because it's a personality that, while largely original to the Bay Area, has saturated mainstream consciousness so thoroughly as to become stripped of all its original subversion. Go to most any party of millennials in Los Angeles or New York, and you'll find the same iridescent sheathed package of psilocybin-studded chocolate being passed around. What was once radical is now mundane. Burning Man is slouching toward Coachella. Richard Dawkins is a farce, and an uneasy realization is dawning that while we all thought we were locked arm in arm in humanity's cheerful march toward progress, we were only wandering into swift approaching regression. Even hard-nosed progressives had begun to sense that something rotten was simmering in the tepid cultural waters. Could it be that what society needed was a return to an ethical framework that had survived throughout millennia? You don't need to do much guesswork to see why smart Christians in Silicon Valley are growing more emboldened. After all, there are billionaires among their ranks. One of them is Peter Thiel, who has spoken about his evangelical leanings for more than a decade, and who has lately shared his views on his faith with increasing frequency. "I believe in the resurrection of Christ," he said in a 2020 talk. "The only good role model for us is Christ. In watching talk after talk of Teal speaking about his faith, I found myself genuinely puzzled. Not because Teal lacks conviction, but because his thoughts on the subject are so galaxy-brained that it seems like he's playing a game of 3D chess that the rest of us are only catching up to. When you don't have a transcendent religious belief, you end up just looking around at other people, and that is the problem with our atheist liberal world. It is just the madness of crowds. And it's not only Teal. Last summer, in an interview with Jordan Peterson, Elon Musk described himself cautiously as a cultural Christian. "I do believe that the teachings of Jesus are good and wise," he said. To have two of the world's richest technologists, worth a recently estimated $400 billion, Musk, and $14 billion, Teal, speak admiringly about biblical teachings challenges the view that Christianity is anti-capitalist or even anti-intellectual. Meanwhile, downstream of Teal and Musk are people like Tan, who is busy shepherding the Valley's next cohort of entrepreneurs and who occasionally tweets scripture from his X account. It's a shift that follows the post-pandemic economic tightening that emboldened some CEOs to publicly embrace right-leaning politics, write corporate statements in support of MEI, or merit, excellence, and intelligence as an antidote to DEI, and that earlier this year had Alex Karp, the CEO of the defense intelligence company Palantir, preaching at the AI Expo for National Competitiveness in D.C. against the thin, corrosive, cancerous, pagan religion infecting our universities. Karp is, of course, referring to wokeism, which many on the right view as an excessive fixation with political correctness, especially as it relates to identity. In recent years, some influential Silicon Valley leaders have compared wokeism to a religion obsessed with original sin, but lacking in redemptive salvation. This same evolution can be charted in the endorsements of formerly liberal venture capitalists. For instance, Chamath Palihapitiya, who after January 6th called President Donald Trump a complete piece of shit-effing scumbag, and who in June co-hosted a glitzy campaign fundraiser on the president's behalf. Within this new political climate, Silicon Valley's ambitions shifted, and along with them, a factory-fresh founder prototype emerged. It used to be that the 20-something whiz kid who coded a viral game and dropped out of Stanford was a venture capitalist darling. "VCs used to throw money at that guy," said a woman who manages communications at a top-tier venture firm. "Now, if someone comes in and says, 'I love my parents so much, I grew up going to church, and then I joined the army, and that's what gives me my work ethic,' VCs will be like, 'Oh my God, that guy, let's fund that guy.'" The inception of this platonic ideal could be traced to the publication of venture capitalist Mark Andreessen's essay, It's Time to Build, in which he argued that over the last few decades, American innovation has fallen short. "Where," he asked, "are our supersonic aircraft, monorails, and high-speed trains?" Western life, specifically American life, was permeated by a sense of smug complacency, a satisfaction with the status quo, Andreessen wrote. This was a problem, in his eyes, that ran deeper than politics. Our entire civilization had lost its way. It was time to return to the world of our forefathers and foremothers who built all the things we now take for granted, he continued. It's time for full-throated, unapologetic, uncompromised political support from the right for aggressive investment in new products, in new industries, in new factories, in new science, in big leaps forward. Silicon Valley is now cultivating projects that embolden a vision slightly grander than that of subscription software. And these projects will be helmed not by some anemic ayahuasca-drinking softie, but by a new kind of entrepreneur, a serious person with a serious vision for the future. The Valley's most powerful venture capitalists are seeking entrepreneurs with the fire in the eyes, the ferocity of speech and action that is the physical manifestation of seriousness, writes Catherine Boyle, a partner at Andreessen Horowitz and co-founder of the firm's American Dynamism practice. "No one wants the Palantir guy to be high on acid for 2 weeks at Burning Man," said that same venture capital communications exec. "You want hard workers. People who are like, I learned that at West Point. We have Israelis who served in the IDF and are religious and conservative and super libertarian. And we're like, yeah, that seems focused. We'll take that." That venture capitalists are seeking a new sort of entrepreneur is an expectation felt palpably among the many aspiring founders at the Code and Cosmos event, who, you get the sense, have businesses that are so far made up of a single pitch deck. You could see it in the gaggle of young, obviously elated entrepreneurial would-bes surrounding Tan. Faces beaming, eager to make small talk about Christianity with one of Silicon Valley's leading investors. "Thank you for saving San Francisco," a woman gushed, referring to Tan's recent involvement in San Francisco politics. He smiled and nodded. The founders encircled Tan ever closer until he was completely surrounded and backed against the wall. They began at first with inquiries relating to Tan's talk, which spanned from the imminent arrival of an omniscient superintelligence to why we should deregulate its use. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.